Hello, I'm Renee Vaughan Sutherland, and welcome to Greater Than 11%, a weekly podcast that explores roles and opportunities within the creative industries, with the aim of contributing to increasing diversity across the board, in addition to promoting some awesome women. For episode 51, I'm joined by set and costume designer Sophie Thomas. Sophie studied theatre design at the Royal Welsh College of Music and Drama, leaving to go on to do a vast range of work in theatre, film, art institutions and live events in a number of roles, such as set design and construction at the South Bank Centre, London, production design for short film New Gods by Jack Burke, set and costume design for the Cambridge Arts Theatre, and production designer for The Long Listener, a short film that went on to make the BAFTA long list. She then was accepted to complete a residency at the Royal Shakespeare Company as an assistant designer in 2015 to 2016, and then quickly went on to establish herself as a set and costume designer with strong conceptual flex and sensitive flair. She's worked on numerous productions over the past 4 years, to name a few: costume designer for the mind-searingly BBC mockumentary by Simon Amstel, Carnage, Swallowing the Past, which resulted in quite a few people I know turning vegetarian and vegan. She then went on to work on My Name is Rachel Corrie, which ran at the Young Vic in 2017. Directed by Josh Roach, it follows verbatim the diary of peace activist Rachel Corrie, who was sadly killed by an Israeli bulldozer. Roach won the Jamie Menzies Kitchen Award for the work, and Sophie's set design gained positive reviews, with the stage stating, "Sophie Thomas's striking yet economical set achieves a real visual punch with the barest of materials. The performance taking place on an empty expanse of plywood panels stained from blood clot red to diffuse sunset pink." Last year, she worked on Kenneth Emerson's play Plastic, a school drama set in a small town in Essex, filtered through the memories of its four characters. The Guardian review of her collaborative work read, "Sophie Thomas and Peter Small are jointly responsible for an ingenious design in which light bulbs whiz through the air on overhead cables." Opening at the end of June this year, her most recent project, Radio, also directed by Josh Roach, is a play about Americans going to live on the moon. Sophie's beautiful set design included a deconstructed American flag that streamed across the set, evoking many number of things, from moonbeams to a rocket taking off. She has participated in the Do Lecture series, giving a talk titled You Are Not Your Role. She discussed attention deficit, attention reform, and attentive kisses. One of my favourite bits is where Sophie discusses paying attention to invisible things, and that you can gain so much power from paying attention to things that don't have words. You can watch her Do Lecture and her Magic Shoes on Vimeo if you're interested in attention and kisses. Sophie, we've had so many near misses scheduling a time to catch up and discuss your incredible skills, talents and career. What a joy to finally welcome you to Greater Than 11%.
Thank you so much for having me, and I am very glad to finally be here. And thank you for being so patient with my schedule.
You've been busy.
As have you, but I'm glad this is happening now.
Cool. So what would be really wonderful is if we can start with you explaining what are the responsibilities of both a costume and set designer.
So in terms of the theatre in which I'm trained and mainly work in, is that you are basically responsible for the visual language. Like, I think you could go as far as saying that everything the audience sees can come down to your decision in collaboration with many people, but you are responsible for what that set and the costume look like as a whole thing. And sometimes it's very lovely because you can collaborate in a very direct way in terms of design. Like, you can be the set designer collaborating with the costume designer, but I generally work as both. But yeah, that basically means you're responsible for that visual language, for the environment and the atmosphere, and then in terms of costume, the sort of essentially the character, but visually. And I suppose to some degree that's stereotypes and archetypes, but I also really enjoy where you can completely disrupt and play with those things in the theatre in terms of those landscapes that we make.
And did you always want to work in set design and costumes? So kind of what's your kind of career history? What led you up to this point?
Yeah, good question. And I feel like I need to be really honest, and I'll try to be concise in terms of the point of your podcast and the idea of career paths. But basically, I could have been the second, fourth generation Dr. Thomas, and there's a massive occupational bias in my family. And so I think at about 17, I'd realised that that wasn't for me. And with full support of my family, they let me do what I was good at, and that quite clearly was art over science. And so then I did the very stereotypical things of doing an art foundation and then just trying to play for that year. And then the good old UCAS form, I just did a bit of research and found the Royal Welsh College of Music and Drama's theatre design course and thought, whoa, this is a hunch, but this sounds interesting. Because I thought at the time I wanted to do fine art at the Ruskin. But that process was really quick. So you start the foundation in September and they wanted you to apply. I think it was in with the sort of first 3 months of that process. And I was like, I've just left home. I'm not ready to make that decision on fine art in 3 months. Do you know what? I'll take the pressure off. I'll just do the art foundation, figure it out. And then at the end of the art foundation, found theatre design. And looked around and genuinely thought I probably would receive a better practical training in many things, picking a theatre course rather than specifically a fine art course, which feels a bit controversial. But having done the course that I did, I've left with a lot of skills and I had tutors every day. I had a desk space for 3 years. The tutor was only around the corner. Like, the quality of education at the Royal Welsh College was good for me. And so, yeah, that led me... That art foundation and that sort of hunch led me to theatre design. But the really honest and open version was that I still didn't know what I was doing. And theatre felt like, really naively, like, one minute I could be an architect and that makes a minute I could be a fashion designer and, oh, but maybe I could paint something too. And, I mean, I definitely don't want to be an actor and on stage, but what does that look like in terms of working with other people? And, yeah, I like the sound of working with lots of people rather than myself in a white room in my studio. So it was very much going with intuition and, like, being playful. I understand the enormous privilege I have had of always having the emotional support of parents and siblings and friends, just being like, if I say I'm going to do something with a smile on my face, they most often than not go, yeah, okay, go. We'll be there if it doesn't work.
That's amazing. I love that you had that, at what must have been a relatively young age, insight to go, I need something that's maybe a bit more practical, maybe collaborative.
I do think the theatre has allowed me to use my imagination as a visual, tactile person in a way that maybe other creative industries... not. It's not that it wouldn't, it's just... The scope at which you and as an individual can push it seems quite large. There's only one set and costume designer. So that idea of that level of autonomy with your imagination, meeting the edges of the imagination of the director and the actor, and there's a lot of scope there, I think. So I do agree with you, but it is an amazing place to make belief.
So you just mentioned working with the director and then the actors. So how does that function? So, you know, the director's kind of overseeing and leading, but you obviously work extremely close with director or directors, but then you're also working extremely close with the actors. So can you talk a little bit about the kind of the way that works in terms of, you know, a new production coming in and kind of the process of that?
It makes sense to me to try and go from the top just because of how my brain works. So it all comes down with the scripts and reading that and going, okay, this is what we've got to come play with. And the director giving you their little hunch or giving you their sort of soundbite, as it were. And then coming in and collaborating with the director once you've got more ideas. But there feels like it's quite a big shift between you and the director have this quite big chunk of time where you're quite intimate and... your thinking is a bit, it's a bit like you're in the womb together. It's safe and it's warm and you don't have to say things too loud and you can play and you can flex. And then the moment that it's cast and you go, okay, I've got some faces to these costume designs, that's lovely. But there's still a bit of time before you meet those individuals. And I always wish that process happened earlier personally with actors, just getting the real people in the room and understanding that there are human beings playing this character, and it's a complex relationship. But it's interesting knowing that those two people, the director or the actors, will come with their own set of skills and their own ideas, and kind of laying down the foundations as the designer early enough because of the practicalities of going, well, this thing needs to be built and your costume needs to be made. I totally want to take on board what you have to offer, but at certain stages of this process, that can sometimes be too late. There can be a knock-on effect of you knowing, well, this amount of work has been sort of predetermined or pre-designed before the process of meeting the cast. But just within my personal process, I always try to actually make sure that that is not as locked down, that if in responding to the individuals, you can see something much more appropriate or much more powerful, you can do that. Mm-hmm. And I feel on a lower scale production, you can. For something like the Royal Shakespeare Company, where, you know, these beautiful costumes and teams of people are going to make these really bespoke, made-to-measure things. They need that information in advance to serve the show, the actors, everyone. But where possible, I try to just really respond to the actors in the room. Yeah, that's the collaborative part of my work that I really enjoy, hearing what everyone has to say and what they bring.
So talking about your work, I mentioned in the intro Radio, which opened at the end of June. So can you tell us a little bit more about what that involved creatively? I didn't see it, unfortunately, but looking at all the images and reading the reviews, like, it was beautiful. I loved that streaming of these, you know, this deconstructed American flag across the set. It was so beautiful, and I can imagine being in that space, what that felt like. So yeah, maybe can you talk about that project and kind of your thought process around it?
Yeah, sure. Again, it's also just massively worth saying it's so collaborative, and it's a pleasure to say that. And I do work with Josh a lot, so part of that process is now sort of shorthanded. There's that language between us, as is normal. Received the script and read that and fell in love with it, and then you see where you go, okay, so that's the line, but what's behind that line, and what am I seeing in between these lines that I know my specific skill set can bring to the table? And that process generally leads into quick sketches, and mainly analogue. When I talk about sketches or modelling, I'm actually referring to a very tactile, old-school way of doing things. So yeah, getting in the sketchbook, like mood boarding, collaging, playing, responding, throwing it back to the director, going, I'm thinking this, I've been influenced by this idea, or harking back somewhere in your brain to that time I was in a museum. But just really responding so deeply to the text, and whenever I go off-piste, it's like, or I've gone down a Google image rabbit hole, go back to the script. And Josh is sort of that beacon and guiding light. And within that early process, I often ask every director I work with, this can be quite a horrible question, but once a little bit of time has gone by and we know maybe where we're going to aim with the design, before I go full hog into that process, because it can be very time consuming and very long, what is it you want your audience to feel when they leave the show? And I often find that answer very useful, and that becomes my sort of North Star in terms of the design process, because it does help that if maybe there are moments the director or members of the team don't quite know what they want, you can go, but that's what we're aiming for. So yeah, that leads into sketches and leads into model making, and that model making can be like a sketch process, and that can be like a bit of icing sugar, a bit of card, like anything that fits to help you show your idea visually to a team of people, knowing that maybe not all of those people will be super visual. So the models can be a very useful process.
When you say showing it to people that maybe not be super visual, who would those people be? Because obviously the director and yourself would have, obviously, like you said, shorthand with Josh, but other people that you work with, they're working with a visual medium, really.
Yeah. And in fairness, I don't think Josh would mind this, but Josh is often reassured by my visuals. He will get it, but when I get the chance to show him specifically what I mean, then he's fully on board. So even some directors, I think, sometimes need that. And then actors seeing what I really mean by the colour or the space that they have in terms of their performance. It's just really grounding, but it's a really good point of reference for further conversations with other people as well, like scenic artists, set construction. So sometimes our schedules can mean that as the designer, you can't be with as many people as you want to be. So if you've done that model really, really well, you can just tell the scenic, here's loads of other information and visual references, but just make that model 25 times bigger than it is.
And scenic construction is?
So the set builders, and they will sometimes technically draw your model up for you. So I do both. So I present them my own technical drawings that I do on the computer and give them the model. And then they will often do much more safe, structured, regimented drawings. Whereas mine will be like, here's the idea.
Yeah.
I've tried to think out as many practical things as possible, and I'm really struggling with this bit. What do you think? But it's always just so important to come back to that model. So yeah, that's that part of the process. And then the rehearsal room comes in and everyone comes together. And in that process, as the designer, you can be in the room as often or as little as your schedule requires, as long as the director doesn't mind. And then within that, you fit your costume fittings and your costume sourcing, visits to the workshop, getting the materials you need. And then hopefully it all comes together quite seamlessly, which it did on Radio. We had a really great team, and it was lovely being in the rehearsal room, watching people play and coming up with lots of different ideas, and many things got cut. But just having that ability in the team that can just embrace play in that room was really fun. Yeah, so after the rehearsal process, you've got your tack schedule where basically everything and everyone comes together for hours on end, and the actors rehearse with the set in costume, lighting, the lights up, the lighting designers there, and sounds there, and it's just that magical moment where everything comes together and you mm-hmm. let the actors really own that stage.
And can I ask you, this kind of flag that I talked about, this big deconstructing, these lovely kind of moonbeams or taking off, where did that kind of idea evolve or come from, or what gave you that idea? Because it's so striking.
The really simple version is still the script. But with this particular project, I could actually show you a reference. So I was doing lots and lots of models with Josh. Mm-hmm. We knew we wanted to embrace the width and lowness of the space because mm-hmm. we didn't have very much money. So I said, we need to embrace the fact we have a very low budget, but what's the room giving us? Do we want to put a set here that's flat with a back wall and a space, and we go, you're now going to imagine this world on this space that's very obviously a space that you're just going to enter with? Mm-hmm. Or do we go, this is a one-man show, and we're going to isolate all of you in this whole space, and we're going to bring you with us, which is what Josh wanted. So it was about bringing this enormous static, sort of intrusive, interruptive feeling into the room. And so as much as the set design was very solid, and it's sometimes sparse, it was trying to be in direct opposition with the space, while at the same time the sort of negative space around the whole set and the room being the harmony that it needed to be so fluid. Mm. Like the actor being able to be in skate parks, to be in Vietnam, to be in Kansas, to be in the center of America, to be in all of these many places in a static set. And very simple things like radio waves, the flag making, the fact that the mother was a tailor and thread. And you just realize just this, sometimes the design just does come from the script and the right conversations. I think sometimes just knowing that your script is your best friend and letting things permeate can really help that process come together.
Because I guess there's a lot of pressure. It depends how much lead time you have, but to come up with something, and I guess knowing, obviously experience helps, but knowing that that idea will come. Anyone who's creative has that moment of when, like, am I ever going to come up with an idea for this? And I'm wondering, do you have that and how do you deal with that?
I do have that. And I think it is a little bit of experience going, no, it's just a tough ride. Yeah. And that's like, might be daunting. If I told my sort of 18-year-old self, like, there are points in this when you're going to just know that experience will get you through, but like, well, I don't have the experience and I've still got to get through it. That's very discouraging. Mm. But it does happen. But I think I was asked this question once before, and it sounds silly, but I just think I have a really almost like librarian archivist knowledge of my magazine racks, my Pinterest, spaces on the internet, my sketchbooks, where I am always storing information, sort of like being like a visual data pirate. Mm. It's not going, I'm going to take that bit of someone else's work here, and it's more just going, I like that, I like that, I like that, yep, collate. Mm-hmm. But having that ability that where maybe ideas are getting thin, you know how to find that idea you had 7 years ago, mm-hmm. or you know that theme. And I don't know how I do that other than I do know just storing all of that influence mm-hmm. and that data, whether that is Pinterest or is sketchbooks. Sometimes even just literally my memory is useful.
And I guess immersing yourself, that's what I find. Just constantly visually feeding yourself. Because something, even if you don't remember it, suddenly will just be like, oh, of course I saw that thing. That was amazing. That something like that could work. Or. So you work in a range of industries. Theatre primarily, but you also have worked in dance, film, TV, events, art institutions. So how does your role differ depending on where you're at and what you're doing?
It's also just worth saying, hopefully without too much imposter syndrome, a part of that diversity is just being young and having to do what comes and going, oh my God, I need money. I don't quite want to take that other job. I'm just going to say yes. And it's also worth saying, I think the theatre training is the thing that proves useful here. And I think it's because you're trained in the live environment. So my training and way of designing things for the live spectacle means that when it comes to like a static image or a TV frame or a camera lens, you go, okay, that's super detailed. I'd never have to think about the dirt on the back of someone's collar in a theatre play unless someone was really close, because mm-hmm. I'm in an opera and the audience are however many metres behind me. Yeah. But I think I have found designing for the live, where the devil is in moments rather than detail, and you cannot control those moments, sort of like emotional alchemy.
Yeah.
Being able to go, what does that live, intangible thing need, makes it an easier jump into what does this more still, static component need, I've found quite useful. So in film, I have finally realised in film I prefer costume for film and TV, and that, so I did costume for Simon Amstel, but I've really enjoyed production designing The Listener, which was a short film, and a few things for a gentleman called Jack Burke. And I think the shift is knowing that your team are an amazing resource when it comes to film and TV, whereas in the theatre, sometimes your team are much more skeletal or much more sporadic, or you can be quite isolated sometimes depending on the budget. So knowing that a really solid team in terms of film and the camera, knowing that that resource is your best friend is amazing. You know, some people are so specialised in film and TV, and it's about embracing all of that knowledge in every individual and going, I'm not even going to pretend I know how to do that special effect or that style of makeup. But I think the main one for me, it goes back to just switching between designing for something that is live and designing for something that is still are two very different things. And it is the level of detail, I feel, that's different.
Mm.
You can be so detailed in film and TV in a way that it's not that you can't in theatre, but you might be missing the point. Where you place your attention, sort of touch on my do talk, where you place your attention as the designer might be a really powerful thing to consider in terms of how your role shifts. That might even be managing people and a team rather than being the designer.
Mm. Cool. Yeah. So can I ask you, is there a typical day for you when you're working, like, say, in a theatre production?
There can be, but I'd say it was within time frames. And at the same time, I instantly want to go, oh, no, there isn't a typical day. Because I think in the theatre, you can be quite autonomous, and that can be very lonely and very hard. And without the right team of people maybe supporting you, whether that's family or friends, like, it has been incredibly tough sometimes.
Mm.
But in terms of a typical process, that might be a better way of going, okay, the days might change. And I think as theatre people, if you are really adaptable, that's such an amazing bonus in terms of your like your attitude and your skills and your I can do it kind of attitude. Yeah, I think there are just sections that are typical, and I am getting better at going, okay, well, this happens in every show. So how do I make this section of the process work better for me as a freelancer that's constantly justifying how I work, has got nothing to compare myself to, and there isn't a HR department. So I'm still getting better at how do I own what a typical day looks like for me, knowing that generally the process is the same.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if that answered your question, but...
Well, it sounds like the process is typical in terms of, you, like you said before, you get the script, you chat with the director, you start mood boarding and researching, and then put together maybe a model and your sketches. And then you go through that process of working with the team that are going to build it, the actors, the costume. But I guess every production's different, and being adaptable to what's coming your way. Because I guess budget influences quite a hell of a lot of how typical the process is.
Yeah, and I would say very recently I've also got better at having some boundaries. So knowing actually the model making process can't take 12 hours a day for 3 weeks, because I'd be earning six times less than minimum wage.
Mm.
You go... Okay, yeah, whoa, hold the phone.
Yeah.
So I'm getting better at placing those boundaries around what low budgets look like, what really low fees look like, and what having an agent to support me looks like, and going, I'm saying no, but I don't even want to tell them to say no. You say no for me.
Mm.
You can play bad cop because I want to keep this relationship healthy here, and I'm no pro at that. But I feel very blessed that I have an agent and I'm learning these lessons now.
And how does that work in terms of freelancing and getting work, or work finding you, you finding work? Obviously, you've got an agent, so they're looking for productions that you can potentially work on. But how typically has that worked for you?
As a general rule of thumb, my agent is a wonderful person, and I generally find that she is incredibly supportive, and it feels like she's protecting me.
Mm-hmm.
Feels like she's on my side. In terms of getting me work, she gets me less work than I think people would imagine, but she's the first person protecting me the minute that I'm on a job and those boundaries need to be in place.
Mm-hmm. So do you get work from, you've worked with Josh a few times, so is it more word of mouth or people see your work and then contact you? I'm just interested as a freelancer within that sphere, how you find work or what finds you.
It's very much still quite old-fashioned in that way, and there is a little bit of who you know or how you appear and how glitzy your name is and how many stars are around your name, so that can make it incredibly tough to find work. But I've just got this sort of mantra of, if I just keep doing it, I will just get better. And that's a privilege to be able to keep doing it. I'm the first person to put my hands up and go, right now at this time in my career I have a part-time job in a members club in a pool, making sure that I can do the theatre work. For the first 7 years of my career, I didn't have to do that. But knowing I'm making the decision to continue and I'm going to continue practicing my job and I will get better, and hoping that that betterness attracts some work. And then sometimes it is the name or the venue or the word of mouth that goes, oh, I've heard you're Sophie. But I am also finding slowly my style, as it were, or what I'm kind of known for, is getting me work. But in terms of having style as a designer, I think that's more a flair or a nuance that people are holding on to, because I still think as a designer, to have a style as a set and costume designer feels counterintuitive. So it's a good mixture, finding work, of who you know, how much you just say yes, how hard you graft, and sometimes it's just a slog.
It's a bit of a long-term journey, or long journey.
Yeah.
That must be tough as well.
Yeah, it's been really tough sometimes. So as you mentioned, I had 1 year at the Royal Shakespeare Company, and I'd freelanced all the way through to that experience. And just before that experience came through and I knew I had it, and I'd applied for it twice, by the way. So speaking of how do you get your jobs, you fail and you try again. Try. So didn't get it the first time. Another year went by freelancing. And basically, I reached a point where people who I was working for weren't paying me on time, and I couldn't afford to live in London anymore. And it's not that, like, oh, every time before I've made it work, this time I couldn't. And I was like, wow, what does that mean? Okay, lose the studio. Lost the studio, couldn't afford it. Just find your rent. Okay, rent's not coming very quickly. I'm going to pay my rent and then tell my landlord they've got their 1 month notice. Wow, I'm leaving London. Okay, that's fine. Oh, thank God I've got that job at the Royal Shakespeare Company to go to. So at the moment that it well and truly slipped for me, I knew I did have a job. So I was like, I'm going to have a summer holiday. And I knew off the back of that very vulnerable experience, freelancing off the back of one of very few salaried positions for a young designer. The trainee designer scheme is amazing and it is salaried. But I knew returning to London as a freelancer would be hard. And no, it didn't last very long. I did a job for the BBC and just knew I couldn't afford to sit anymore, and sometimes it is so hard that things need to change. And for me, that looked like geographically moving. And there are many reasons, I think, with the economy, like personal, there are so many reasons why it was good and why it needed to be done. But I think for me personally, with all the hassle that can come with freelancing and how hard that can be sometimes within the theatre world specifically, has meant that I'm much more emotionally, financially and mentally fit working in Bristol and living in Bristol. Even though a lot of my work is still in London, amazingly and weirdly, it's more manageable living in Bristol. That move has directly come from how tough and hard it is being a theatre designer and freelancing in the city.
I do find it incredible in creative industries, and that's across the board, that young people, people exiting university, people with little experience, which is in keeping with where they are in life and what they've been through, are paid so badly or expected to work free. It's unbelievable, and the knock-on consequences of that are just so severe. Yes, you're fine, you're in Bristol and you've kind of worked it out, but you know, it would also be beneficial to stay in London and to be able to work. And I just find that incredible that this is continued and continues. It's disheartening.
There'll be a weird uprising of something magical somewhere, I'm sure
Good.
Of it.
I can imagine you'll be leading the way.
Encouraging, if not leading. But I do think to anyone that specifically is thinking about a theatre design industry, it's worth knowing that designers are, it can be very lonely and isolating, but when we get together, it is like an encouragement family.
So tell me, what skills do you need to be a costume and set designer?
To go straight back to attention to detail would feel very important, because that's such a malleable thing. But I wouldn't underestimate really good research, particularly in the early stages of designing a set or a costume, because sort of what sometimes the difference in theatre and film I found is the nature of it being period accurate to a T. Mm-hmm. And sometimes in the theatre you've got a lot more flex around that, depending on what you want to do with the show. And then I would say adaptability, which we've already touched on, is really big. And tenacity. Tenacity to just stick at something when you really don't want to, or you do get really bored, because some of the skills that you get, whether that's technically drawing and particularly model making in terms of set design, just practice and repetition will just make you better and better. Mm. I was not the best model maker in university, but I have modelled shows for the Royal Shakespeare Company. So if I can be model making at Royal Shakespeare Company, anyone can. Mm. So just being tenacious. And like maybe to some degree, like knowing your limits a bit, knowing maybe if I was speaking to an 18-year-old me, having some like core values and boundaries that I knew I didn't want to cross, going, I don't want to be that kind of designer for X reason, or I'm not into that kind of work for, might mean you just save so much more energy climbing that early ladder with the stuff that you know you're good at, or the stuff that you are interested in, and you can take a bit more space in those areas, knowing that, but this is what I want. But pick a good university because you can learn a lot there. Mm. You know, so I didn't have everything I needed, but really picking the right uni where I got a lot of attention and I got a lot of time and had a lot of resources, I think is the game changer. And I do owe the Royal Welsh College an awful lot.
So what I think is really interesting there is that you touched upon values, which is something that we all inherently have. But actually, I think it's such a good like exercise to sit down and go, what are my values and what will I not be flexible on? Like, I think that, and that helps set boundaries and things. That's something I learned late in life. And it makes a huge difference. It's like a compass. Like, mm-hmm. I know I don't want to work on that job because that is actually going to really compromise this value of mine. Mm. So yeah, I think that's super advice.
Thank you. I mean, it feels like cheeky advice because I'm literally saying it because I'm in the middle of learning it. I think it will just help that long-term resilience and the long-term vision. And just sort of very loosely going, if I put a little bit of work on future values, how can that help me with my career and what I say yes and no to, mm. in terms of, yeah, keeping me resilient but smiling and there for opportunities when they come.
Can I ask you, what's been one of the biggest challenges you've faced in your career?
I think there have been many, and at a really early stage this is quite basic, but understanding when some problems are just freelancer problems, mm-hmm. and you're sort of taking it so personally and thinking it was such a niche problem. And then I found other freelancers that weren't even in theatre. And I'm like, wow, people who work a 9-to-5 know that it's Friday because they have routine. And I'm here still thinking it's Tuesday because I've just worked for 7 days in a row. And you go, oh, other freelancers. So it was like this really funny, lovely moment when I realised actually some of the stuff I was struggling with when earlier in freelancing was just self-employed stuff.
Yeah.
And being able to de-attach myself from how personal I had made that problem. The overarching solution to many problems feels like if I had a community and a village, the problems would have been easier. Mm-hmm. So there have been many big problems. And I feel like if I had had a community or a sense of belonging or even a handful of really good friends when I was in London, mm. or at particular times, managing the bigger problems would have been easier. And I'm not comparing a career to a child, but that saying of sometimes it takes a village to raise a child feels like a really smart way to look at a career in terms of whether you don't know whether it's right for you or it's really tough and you literally can't pay your bills right now. Just going, what does the wider view of how I can make this work if I am emotionally vulnerable with it, if it's worn me down to burnout, if like what things outside of you can help you. Yeah. So I feel my biggest problem was not having local friends, living in a city like London where they were literally not here, but they could have been 40 minutes away or an hour on the tube. Mm. So I feel like a community, not having a really good community, mm. has been a particularly big problem, and I am making the space to make that.
Yeah, that is interesting. I've not really thought about that. But I think also not being a native Londoner, like when I first came to London, finding that community took some time because it's a big city and people have their cliques. Once you're in, but it can take time to get in that. It can be quite isolating. I also think And something, again, I've learned later on, but I also see in other people that I've chatted to on the podcast and stuff, actually having mentors within that community. And that can be an informal arrangement, but I'm about to burn out, or I haven't got any money to pay my rent. And being able to ask someone with more experience within that community to help shape, guide you, support you emotionally, I think that's so key.
And I think just another sort of hands up to my agent, maybe the closest thing I particularly have now is that, you know, the idea of one of my bigger problems would be having the resilience to do the projects without her. I just wouldn't have. So having her, it's been a game changer in terms of my energy and going, I've got these problems and I just need one person that I trust to talk about these with.
That's awesome. And how did you and your agent come together? Because that's actually quite key, isn't it?
I was just really bullshy and I called her and I said, I would like to speak to you. I felt like I'd known I wanted to do that and I knew I wanted to speak to her for about 2 years. So it was about timing and it was going, is this ego-led? Is this fear-led? Is this desperate-led? What have I got to show her? What do I want? And trying to do that groundwork before wasting this poor woman's time. Yeah, I just did a bit of research on their agency and thought, oh, they seem a little bit niche. They seem a little bit little. They've definitely got some big clients, though. Okay, this feels right. And it goes back to that sort of intuition on in choosing the degree back in that UCAS, just having a general overview of some really basic stuff that I knew I wanted, or just embracing that I didn't know. I didn't know whether I wanted to do theatre design, but it felt like the best thing. I didn't know whether I wanted an agent, but she felt like the best thing. And I set up that meeting, and I don't and won't really forget the moment that after a very lovely sort of 20 minutes, half an hour, she turned around and said, but I do suggest that you go and talk to other agents because we are all different. And I just squared her in the eye and said, yes, Rachel, but there's a reason why I'm talking to you. Because I knew that I wanted her. And then the rest of the conversation just completely iterated both ways why I think we wanted to work with each other. So I just think be bold and be confident, but respect that. I mean, she's been in the industry a long time. So it was trying to show up as the newbie, but respecting that Rachel has been in this a long time, and that her time is precious.
I want to say that I love watching you speak and talk and articulate. I definitely get a sense of your like creative process. It's really lovely to watch, like the way that, and I can see that in the work, you know, that I've looked at that you've created. And I mentioned it in the intro, you have such a conceptual flex, but such a sensitive flair. And yeah, that is just coming out in all that you're talking. So, so lovely to watch.
Thank you very much. That means a lot.
So can you tell me, what do you love about being a costume and set designer?
I love a few things, but so many of my friends and family and many people who know me would know that I'd be doing a disservice to listeners if I pretended like that question wasn't impossibly hard, because there is so much that I don't love. And I well and truly burnt out about 9 months ago. And to some degree, I've been quite transparent about that. I've been transparent about it with new directors that I'm meeting as of recovering. I took about 8 months of not working going, whoa. And like the doctor was like, you do not need me to tell you that you need to stop. And I was like, well, I've got to pay my bills, hence this job at the pool. So I was like, yeah, I'm going to stop. And Josh, the director I work with a lot, was very supportive. Kind of was a bit scared. Was like, okay. I was like, don't worry, designer dating is good. You should have more than one. So there are many things I love. I love storytelling. I love the autonomy. I love the level at which you can push your imagination without someone telling you, but yeah, here's the brief. I'm like, yeah, the brief's the script, but you've employed me like to design it in collaboration with lots of people, you know, and it's a privilege having that much, like this could be fine art, this could be realistic, this could be naturalism, you know, there's something brilliant in that scope. So I love the scope. I love the teamwork. I love the collaboration. I love that when that many egos and people get one thing right and this show actually makes the audience feel something, you go, girl, well, blimey, there was a lot of people to please to make that happen and we did it. I love the audience's reaction. I love the concept of the audience, this collective mind. I love that it's live. But I think loving something, I was just so naive to knowing that it wasn't really following my passion. It was following values. Like I burnt out because so many of my values and my identity was based in my career. And then the pressure of thinking I have to afford my rent by this means through my identity. So there's this really weird circular cycle of destruction that makes you go, wow, the love has been absolutely burnt out of me. And to some degree, that's a blessing. Those boundaries haven't come from nowhere. Mm-hmm. But that process of going, wow, I now need to recover from burnout and go, this is probably much deeper than I think it is. And so just invested in a life coach and invested in trying to understand why I reached that place over other people. I probably in hindsight can now say I've loved that journey too. Mm-hmm. And I hope it just makes me a more sensitive designer because I work with human stories for human people and we're all flawed and we all fall in love and sometimes our love burns us. Do what you love. Just make sure that your core values are not abused by people who do not respect your core values. There'll be things that are so important within your love of what you do. Some of them need to be safe or tended to. And they don't need to shine all year.
That is amazing, Sophie. And I'm so pleased that you've made it through that journey and still love working on costume and set design. Because sometimes it can be burnt out of you and people don't want to touch their creativity again. And that quells something as well, because it does need to come out. So, yeah that's awesome.
Thanks.
So, where do you go to fuel your creativity? What do you do? What do you see?
I think the honest answer now, I've burnt out, is like doing nothing that feels creative in that way. Mm. Just because actually I struggle with the word creative because it's not an industry, creative. Mm. It's not an industry. It's not a typecast. It's not a stereotype. It's not something you can buy. It's something that human beings are. We're adaptable, creative things. So I think what I found post-burning out is that what fuels my creativity is allowing myself the time to love my boyfriend to bits. And doing some exercise and going, God, it's sunny outside. I'm going to go and manipulate my freelance day so that I can do that thing that will fuel the bit that I need to do in a bit. So I actually think just being curious and understanding what a healthy pause looks like is probably fueling my creativity now in a more meaningful way than caning loads of museums and going to lots of films. And I'm sure that will change throughout my life. Mm-hmm. But right now, it's finding what kind space looks like.
I just love that term, caning lots of museums.
Go, 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 go. I don't live in London anymore. Go, 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 go. Money, 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 quick.
All right. What advice would you give someone considering a career within costume and set design?
I think know that you want to do both and understand to some degree you will not be master of either of them. And I do feel that imposter syndrome sometimes when you're working with the most amazing costume makers going, wow, you can sit on a sewing machine in ways that I can't. And they're going, whoa, maybe at the same time, maybe I have different skills too. And that's why this is happening. I think my advice would be just own who you are and how you do it, though. Really knowing the more people you work with, the more you'll realize that people flex around the designer. And I sometimes go, you're figuring out how I work, but I'm also not going to bite your head off. So how do you work? And I'm slowly realizing that I like working with people so much to the point that I want their experience of working with me to be wholesome as well as productive. But I think it's about finding your way of working and owning that, knowing no one's going to tell you how to do it. And it can be very lonely being the designer. So just own your way of working and really stand in that, knowing that if you can't be master of all of these little things, you can at least do it your way and do that really sensitively. I think really in terms of maybe problem solving some of the bigger problems, is if you can just don't understand that the value that someone puts on you with your paycheck equals your worth, which I think as a young theatre designer, I wish someone maybe had told me when I was going, I'm going to work £300 a month for X person. And that therefore means I am worth, I don't know, 4p an hour. And I think what's just been really interesting in learning in the long run, somewhere along the line, maybe my self-worth had been devalued by me because I'd associated that with my income, which isn't naturally the way, I think. But I think sometimes when you struggle so much just to exist, it's very easy to then go, wow, just trying to pay my rent and eat something that isn't 2 bagels a day is coming at a price, and I'm being given this price. there's a little conundrum there. So I think just knowing your worth and knowing there is a limit to how much free work you can do, and there is so much power to saying no.
Mm.
Knowing that other people, yes, will take the job that you just said no to, but there'll be a reason that they came to you before and they won't have those skills because you've just said no, and they may have a product that is not of the same value or calibre because of that, and just standing by that, which is really hard to do in the beginning.
It is hard. And also when you're ambitious and you want to work on great things, and you know that creativity or the possibility to explore imagination, creativity, is a lure often over cash for creative people.
Mm.
But then you get in that trap cycle where you are earning 4p an hour or whatever.
Yeah.
And then the love starts dissipating, so...
Mm. That is a really valid point.
Mm.
And yeah, there is that urge for many people.
Definitely.
That's really valid.
Mm. I'm so pleased that you've made it, because you've been so busy. And we're coming to the end of this series. There's 52 in total, so you're the second last. Yay!
Congratulations as well, though. Thank like, you've had a dream and you've made it happen and you're nearly at the end. Like, how does it feel?
It feels great. Pat and I were talking about it today, and that, when we set off on this journey, we kind of just thought, oh, yeah, we'll have a handful of listeners and it needs to be done, so we're going to do it. And, it's grown over time. We've met some incredible people. What a privilege to talk to talented, skilled, intelligent, driven women every week. I never kind of anticipated that. I didn't have that in mind when I set out on that journey. And that to me has been such a rich experience and met so many wonderful people. And our listens are getting up and we get lots of lovely feedback. So it feels amazing.
That's really lovely to see and hear.
So we're coming to the end of our episode, but before you go, I'm wondering if you can tell me what you've got coming up in the next few weeks or months, or are you just having a summer off?
I am having a summer off. This is in terms of learning things about burnout.
Mm-hmm.
It's also about understanding where I am within my own emotional, financial, mental fitness and going, what do I need? What does that look like? One of the things in my family that's never left me as a bunch of medics is this idea that prevention is better than cure. And going, so how do I prevent one thing happening rather than reaching it and needing the cure?
Mm.
So that is going to look like time off. It's going to earn like a little bit of money on the side to keep things stable. But immediately it will be a show in Edinburgh called The Resurrection of Bobby Orr, written by a conceptual artist called Brian Catling. And then the real wild card, whether it's to do with love or not, I'm not too sure, is that I'm exploring, with full support of my agent, doing a master's in landscape architecture.
Wow.
So I don't know if I'm going to get it, and it's horrible to say it out loud because I might be rejected, but I think there is a new chapter ahead of me, as cliche as that sounds, and that's called actually investing in my practice and being a bit less concerned about where the money comes in so naively, maybe.
Mm.
I don't know. There'll be something, but I feel like I really want to return to education. So we'll see.
That's super exciting.
Thanks.
So cool. All right, before you go, one something I ask everyone. Is there a job or career in the creative industries across the board that you know little about? And potentially I could find someone in that role, get them on the podcast. And also, is there a woman you would nominate for me to get in contact and get on Greater Than 11%? Maybe for series two.
So there are two separate questions there. I've got an answer for the second one.
Mm-hmm.
So who was the woman that I would really love to hear say all this stuff? It would have to be my favourite artist ever, just because I'm obsessed with her and I think she's a genius and she's a living artist. I think she's incredible. So that's Agnes Dens, and I hope I've said her name right. I've never met her. But she was... Are you familiar with her work?
I do, no.
The Wheatfield.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
I mean, I just think right now with this, the environmental crisis and... Your Greater 11 being about women, that is a woman that has always had something to say. She is pioneering and she is a genius.
Mm.
So I would, if that would be possible, I would love to hear what she has to say. Mm. And what was the first question?
So what is a career job in the creative industries that you know little about and always been curious about, and potentially I could get someone in that role on?
So I think I'd like to see something to do with the graphics and information that on the surface feels really tedious, but is like insanely important, like medical graphics that are inclusive or like motorway signs. Like how do you vision, because I so don't deal with flat images at all. I would be so baffled as to know how do you communicate really crucial, simple information to people at like a flash.
Yeah, that's a good shout.
And just like how inclusive it is as well, just being like, do all patients that have X look like X?
Yeah.
Just being like, what does the future of like medical graphics or annotation or illustration look like maybe? I mean, that's definitely my parents' career shining through there.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm still so interested in healing people and how people do that. But yeah, I think that kind of visual language would be fascinating to know more about.
I agree. And same with road signs. I love road signs. Just wherever you go in the world, you know, they're like, we've got all, you know, a stop sign can look so different depending on where you are.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
But the universality of that would be so fascinating to know someone's designed that.
Yeah. Oh my God, I've so loved chatting to you. Thank you so much, Sophie, for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me, and like, just congratulations with 11%, really. I think it's been fantastic to be a part of, and I can't believe you're at the end, really.
I know.
But yeah, really well done.
Cool. Thank you. Thanks. This podcast is made possible by the support of Hub, an insight-led content agency based in London. A huge thank you to the producers, Pat Murray and James Haverson, our editors, Daniel Clark and Laura Francis, and to Maria Contenenza for designing the beautiful artwork.